welcome to the January edition of Sip for Speaks, the premier podcast for professionals working in public finance. Happy New Year! It is January 2020, the start of a new decade. I hope all of you listening had a wonderful festive break, however you may have chosen to spend that. We've got a great show coming up for you today. We were joined by Nigel Brooks from West Yorkshire Police, talking to us about Operation Uplift and some of the broader challenges in policing in the UK. We're also joined by Dr. Kitty Stewart from the London School of Economics, who joined us to talk about the impact of Brexit on UK social policy. So both fascinating interviews, but first up we have Dominic Brady, a reporter from Public Finance magazine, who's here to talk about the intensely packed news agenda that dominated the festive period. How are you today, Dom?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
Enjoying the new year so far?
I am, yeah, it's been full on.
So I am here to talk public finance news with Dominic today. Obviously we're entering 2020 in the wake of the most recent of many general elections. It's been a turbulent winter, to say the least. I don't think anyone expected a Conservative majority of the scale that was actually achieved. So, did you guys in the press world get any indication of the scale of the victory that was coming?
No, didn't at all. I think all the polling in the lead-up to the election was favouring Tories. A lot was made of the Times MRP poll, the same poll that predicted the 2017 election. But even that was quite a way off, I think, with a majority of 68. And then that was later reduced down to just 28. Take from that what you will.
So suffice to say, it was kind of a surprise for everybody.
It was a surprise, no doubt, for Boris himself. The Tory party had a clear plan to capitalise on the Labour heartlands that had voted Leave. And I think that's what we saw borne out in the results. It was a lot made of Labour's red wall, which effectively crumbled. The ultimate difference was the message to get Brexit done. And I think Labour couldn't match that with their stance on Brexit. But there's other factors you can point to, like the anti-Semitism controversy, and also the Lib Dems, who perhaps 2 years ago maybe were expected to do a bit better. But the eventual decision to come out and say we'll cancel Brexit and to overturn it without a second referendum, that was massively unpopular. So I think that's where Tories managed to come through at the end.
We're now rolling at pace towards leaving the EU on the 31st of January. Whether you're Remain or Leave, obviously it's coming towards us at some pace now. What do you think the immediate impacts of that are going to be? From the conversation that you've been having with various players in the sector, do you think they're welcoming some direction? Does this count as the clarity that people have been calling for?
People will be grateful for the clarity of direction. I mean, the Brexit bill's going through the Lords, I think, as we speak. But I think the most immediate impact, I suppose, will be in the financial markets come 1st of February. For public services, I imagine the effects will be felt more long-term. We know about the issues facing the health and social care sector. Staffing shortages with less staff coming in from abroad is possible to be tricky for that sector in the coming months and years. There's something like a gap of 100,000 NHS staff, which we need to make up. The King's Fund noted that the situation in nursing is quite bad. In 2018-19, only 968 nurses and midwives from the EEA joined the Nursing and Midwifery Council's NMC register, and that's a decrease of 91% since 2015-16. So
wow.
That kind of goes some way to showing the scale of the problem. But as we go forward, I think what councils and communities will be looking out for is details of the UK Shared Prosperity Fund. It's been a long time coming. I think it was promised in the 2017 Conservative Manifesto that they'd consult on it by the end of 2018. We're now in 2020 and still nothing. That money runs out in 2021, I believe, and it's around 22.1 billion a year from the EU in regional development funds. So I imagine there'll be a lot of anxiety within communities and local authorities to see what the detail of the UK SPF is going to be.
So some certainty, but still plenty of questions that you're answering.
Plenty of questions still, yeah.
And on that workforce front, later in the episode, we're going to be speaking to Dr. Kitty Stewart from the London School of Economics. We'll be talking about the impact of Brexit on social policy in the UK. So I imagine that's something that we'll be touching on later on in the show. But of course, Brexit is not the only story. The Chancellor has now announced that the budget is going to be on the 11th of March. Any early predictions for what we can expect from Mr. Javid?
I don't expect any big surprises. There's been a lot of talk, you know, because we had the party conferences September, October time, and then there was the election, so there's been plenty of talk about what future governments might do. Big one, I suppose, is infrastructure. Javid set that out in his conference speech, promising an infrastructure revolution. And I think the expectation is that that spending on infrastructure is going to be directed at the north of England. Interestingly, HS2 back in the news with a former review board member coming out saying it could top top 100 billion and it's all done. So it'll be interesting to see where Boris Johnson comes out on that one. Elsewhere, the striking thing about the election campaign was that both parties were almost in agreement that public spending in general needs to go up. There's things around hospital spending. We've seen capital funding announcements. Boris Johnson's also promised to increase the threshold at which like national insurance contributions. So if that will be in there, optimistically, we could wait for a social care announcement. Boris Johnson said when he took office that he had a plan for social care. It's massively difficult to do politically. Currently, there's a one-year settlement in place for councils worth 1.5 billion. 500 million of that is raised through council tax. That will do for the year, but I think what the sector needs and what the sector has been asking for is a long-term settlement. There could be a massive surprise in the budget, but I wouldn't hold your breath.
Well, of course, the new government have been talking about moving straight to a social care white paper. Obviously, there are some concerns there around a certain amount of consensus building that needs to be done before that stage. So one wonders if it would end up being a little bit dead in the water or dead on arrival.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the sector, having spoken to people in charity sector, people in local authorities, it's just the frustration and the lack of clarity. You know, it's been delayed, I think, maybe six times now, the green paper, and now, as you say, it might be rolled into a white paper. So the sector's growing impatient and they want to get it done.
Understandably so. Mm. Now, one of my favourite stories from the Christmas and New Year period was Dominic Cummings' job ad for number 10 positions, the blog that he put out calling for misfits and weirdos. I'm intrigued. Do you think that that kind of novel approach to recruitment is right for the public sector?
Yeah, I mean, it was a bit odd, wasn't it? And it certainly caused a storm in the Twitter sphere, political commentators tearing their hair out. But maybe it's a good thing, shaking up the norms. I don't know if it is successful, or in fact, I think he's actually been told that he won't have a role in recruiting civil servants. I think the Times reported that he can have a hand in selecting special advisors, but not civil servants. But I think it's indicative of the general direction that the government's moving in. There's been a lot of talk of Dominic Cummings' war on the civil service. Certainly, there are calls from other organisations, people like the Institute for Government, who have been saying for some time that civil service can do with a bit of an overhaul. Whether a personal blog post broadcast on Twitter or whatever is the way to do it, I'm not so sure. But it's certainly, I will say for it, that it reached many more people than it would have had it just been advertised on gov.uk, probably.
So, thank you very much for joining us today, Dominic. When is the next edition of Public Finance due out?
That should be out early February.
Great. So, for any subscribers, look out for that dropping onto your doorstep. And where can people go to find out more information?
Yep, you can visit our website, publicfinance.co.uk. We have almost daily newsletter that goes out, so do sign up for that for all the latest public sector news.
Great. Thank you very much for joining us today, Dom.
Thanks, Ashley.
Well, it certainly was a winter that none of us have expected. We now have a Conservative majority, and time will tell what policy change in this country is going to look like. Next up, we have Nigel Brooks from West Yorkshire Police to talk about the challenges facing policing and his projections for police forces in light of the new government.
I'm Callahan Hager, and I'm here with Nigel Brooke, Assistant Chief Officer for the West Yorkshire Police. How are you, Nigel?
I'm very well, thank you. And you?
Yeah, doing well, thanks. So we're here today to discuss your current work at the West Yorkshire Police and broader issues around police force funding in the UK. So to kick things off, Nigel, can you give us an idea of your current role and your work here in West Yorkshire?
Certainly. As Assistant Chief Officer, that makes me the Chief Financial Officer and responsible for things like the Finance Department, the IT Department, the Estates, Transport and Project Boards, and part of the Chief Officer team. But nationally, I'm the National Police Chiefs Council Finance Committee Vice Chair, and that's quite a mouthful, which sees me getting involved in things like spending reviews, settlements, formula reviews, that kind of thing. I've been in this particular role about 15 years, but in policing for 24, I think, coming up to 25. So I'm going to be one of the old man of policing. It's changed quite a bit over that period, so it wouldn't be fair to sort of assume that it's the same role as I do now as I did at the beginning.
What do you think the biggest changes have been?
I think the speed of change is the same as society. Everything happens so fast now. The email revolution means the volumes of things that hit your desk, the speed with which it's expected to reply to it, the number of initiatives we run in parallel. At one time, we would have chosen what the priority was and dealt with that, then done something else. Now you'll try and run four or five major projects in parallel. The risk and difficulty is magnified disproportionately. And I don't think that's unusual around policing at the moment. I think the police service is up against it in a number of ways, but not just in the front line. I think the back office is extremely busy.
What do you see as the major finance-related issues for the West Yorkshire Police as well as the broader police force across the UK?
Well, the first must be austerity. Austerity has bitten very deep in the police service, and it's been disproportionately applied. Because it was a percentage of grant cut, the areas that were most reliant on grant, the more deprived areas, had the bigger cuts, and also seemed to be the forces with the lowest precept, so they had the less alternative funding sources. So the impact on places like West Yorkshire, West Midlands, Greater Manchester, were far more severe than some of the other Shire counties. And that has really made its mark, because we're so thin on the ground in terms of workload. At the same time, we've had increases in demand. So the scale and complexity of policing has grown hugely. Things like historical child sex abuse cases, we have large numbers of them, very, very resource intensive to pursue. And they were extreme rarity previously. So the workload has gone into that, and yet we've got fewer people. So we're having to prioritise. And what prioritise means is some things don't get done, or some things get done less well. And that, clearly the public realise that. So there's quite a bit of criticism sometimes about the poor rates of prosecution or pursuit of particular types of crime, because we're having to prioritise and choose between things. So I'd say austerity was number one. The annual budget balancing exercise every finance director has, constantly difficult. We get inflation, people get pay rises, we don't get an increase in budget. That means you've got to make cuts somewhere to make it balance. So this year is just the same as every other. It's really important that when you've got something like austerity that you don't stand still. You've still got to develop your services, change your services, invest in new technology and so on. And finding the money for that makes the austerity cuts even worse, because you're having to take even more money out to reinvest in other areas. At the moment, the theme is digital forensics, because about half of our actual demand is for cyber-related and cyber crime, and yet a tiny proportion of our resources is put into that. So we're trying to beef up all that side. And every crime that's done, everybody now has their phone is a big computer. They've got multiple computers at home, the CCTV evidence and all that, all these processing by digitally skilled people. So we're really investing in the digital side. And that money's got to come from somewhere, because it's not coming from external sources. So it means moving money around in the organisation. So interesting times, those sort of things.
It seems like you've really been feeling financial squeeze. Do you think that's been getting worse in recent years?
I think the early years of the austerity cuts were the worst. The Home Office received a 20% cut early on. And then in the latter years of austerity, it was more either minor percentage decreases or flatlining. So I can't claim it's got worse, but because you had the really bad years first, it got really tough. Overall, it still feels pretty tough, but the early first 3 or 4 years were definitely the worst. And I think the PCC has done what he can to try and alleviate that by increasing the precept a little, since the government's allowed that. And that's just taken some of the sting off the last couple of years. But it's still not easy to balance the budget each year. And there are a few national initiatives coming out that are making it worse. The EFQM is the latest acronym. This one is Police Education Qualifications Framework. What's happened is they're calling it professionalising the training of police officers. So they're linking with higher educational institutions to put the training on a formal basis for police officers. It now takes 3 years to do instead of 2 years. And most of the time's in the university, not doing policing. So at the very time when we need the people the most, because we're actually hard-pressed, more of our people are going out there to do university educations, leaving us with 2 to 3 years before they come back to do policing. So we've got the fewest number of people, and all these extra 20,000 officers that are being given to us, assuming we manage to recruit those, and that's a challenge itself, they will be at the college not doing policing. So it'll be 2 or 3 years before we see any benefit from them. Right. So there are quite a few sort of hurdles put in our way like that that are somewhat different to what people might think.
So it's a current strain on the resource that you have at the moment, and it's even more difficult to actually help support or replenish that.
Yes, indeed. And the lag, everybody will expect, oh, you've got some more officers, you're recruiting more officers, therefore the service will get better. In fact, it possibly will get worse for 2 years until those officers actually arrive from being trained. And it could be as long as 3 years, because it's only towards the latter end of their training that they actually start to do something productive.
Building on that as well, what are your thoughts on the national recruitment campaign to recruit 20,000 new police officers over the next 3 years? How do you think that's likely to pan out?
I think we'll manage it. Police Service is really good at rolling up its sleeves and getting stuck in and doing it and delivering it. So I think it will be done. The challenges are considerable because you're really increasing the volumes of recruits, the volume of people needing tutoring, which means taking experienced people from doing what they do now to helping somebody else. The extra costs of the university is involved in the process and the staff doing the recruiting. So it's not an easy thing, but clearly I'd want it to happen. So I welcome it, but it's a challenge and it'll be quite a while before the benefits start to land. There are also some concerns that there will be bids for those officers not to reach forces. People like the National Crime Agency, counter-terrorism units, they would like to get some of the 20,000. And unless all 20,000 reach forces, we're not even reaching the numbers we had before austerity. And yet there's great expectations about what we'll deliver with these extra resources. So it's good news, and I do not knock it, but it won't be a panacea that solves our problems.
On a more positive note, what do you think are some of the financial successes, positive developments of the police force over the past year or so?
I think we've done really well to slow the increasing crime. And now, that doesn't sound too fantastic, but I think looking at the volume of people we've taken out the front line, the fact that crime has not gone up very, very steeply is quite a testament to the work of officers and their managers in tackling it. And in some areas, we're now seeing some reductions, which is actually very encouraging. Certainly locally, we're beginning to see some really encouraging signs on things like violent crime. So there are some green shoots of positivity in terms of the policing. The work on demand reduction has been something I'd highlight. Most forces, including ourselves, have put some resources into demand reduction. So, for example, missing persons. We put an enormous amount of police officer time looking for people who go missing. By doing demand reduction, working with partners like the children's homes, like the local authorities, if we can bring that number down a little bit, it releases an enormous amount of our police officer capacity to do other priority work. And we've had some notable success on that. I think the latest numbers are about 15% reduction in the number of missing persons. Another one would be contract management. We were very good at doing compliant procurement, and we were quite good at then putting more compliant procurement out when the contract ran out. We weren't so good at managing the contract during the life of the contract. Did we get the price we said we would pay? Did we get the service we were actually paying for? And in the relationship, was there a contract on negotiations over variations, etc.? We weren't so good at all that. And by getting a real grip of it, and in some cases deciding we don't need that service or we can do it a different way, we've saved about £3 million a year over the last year. And I think there's more to come. I think income generation would probably be another one we're starting to tackle better. Looking at how we might get things like advertising revenue for putting advertising hoardings in our sites, or looking at filming rights over some of our older buildings. Those kind of things are relatively marginal sums, but we can bring in some money that helps to run the budget. We're very good at preparing police vehicles, so we could do it for other forces. We already do it to some extent. Could we do more? So things like that, that just bring in little sums, help to the budget to balance a bit better than it used to do.
What changes would you like to see for the police force over the next 10 years or so?
Very much personal views, but I would rationalise the number of police. There's been some coverage in the press this week as a result of comments by Martin Hewitt, the NPCC chair. I actually agree with that. I think there are too many forces. Police Scotland is one force. Northern Ireland has one force. I think England probably needs one per region, so Yorkshire and Humber should probably be one force, I think. That would simplify some of the complications in terms of formula to give the right amount of money to each force, and that you'd be talking about a region, so it'd be more averaged out itself, as well as providing some efficiencies. Everybody has to have one of everything. Well, the fewer forces there are, the fewer that you need to pay for. And I think they'd have more sort of centralised professional teams running things and less complicated collaborations to set up. So they are quite expensive in terms of time consumed setting up a collaboration. So I'd rationalise. I think probably the most important element would be consistent investment. If we knew we were getting inflation rises each year, as has been promised for something like the NHS, even if that were just provided with a fraction more for investment, then knowing that were coming for a number of years would enable us to take rational, planned decisions for the long term and know that there was a little bit more coming next year, so we could do something then, do something now, and plan for the long term. Just that kind of consistency, rather than you get a budget settlement this time, bang, there's the 20,000 officers, but you don't know what's coming next. There's no long-term planning. It makes it very difficult for people like me to do long-term planning. Other than that, I think investment in our partners, things like mental health services, drug and alcohol services, youth services, housing improvements, how much better would society be if those kind of services were improved? And we would then have less firefighting to do in terms of people driven to crime, getting involved in unhealthy lifestyles, going missing from children's homes, etc. So our society would be so much improved, and our jobs would become so much easier. So I think a lot of it would be investing in our partners to provide a better service. And lastly, I think if the economies of the North and the Midlands actually get the attention that the government are currently saying they're going to do, that should help drive some of the focus onto getting a job, doing better in life, and less on resorting to drug dealing or other types of crime to offset the fact you've got no money, and less idle time to get involved in antisocial behaviour and general misbehaviour. So I think there's a huge amount riding on getting the poorer regions of the UK towards the standard of the rest of the country, and that would transform these areas so that we would have less crime to fight.
Just to wrap things up today, do you think the new Conservative government that we have in the UK and their manifesto pledges, their new spending plans, do you think all that will really work to change things for the better and strengthen the police in the coming year?
I think it would be fair to say this: the government is very new. The things that they've said in their manifestos, and certainly the Home Secretary has already written to the NPCC setting out some of the things like the 20,000 officers, tackling violence, protecting officers, legal sanctions on offenders, the serious organised crime review and how you tackle serious organised crime. I don't know the answer to that, but the review is quite important. Looking at the formula and the distribution between forces and better settlements, I think those things, if they're fulfilled, could make quite a difference. So I'm quite hopeful that some of the right things are on their agenda, and now look forward to seeing how they deliver that.
Excellent. Thank you so much for your time, Nigel.
Thank you.
Been listening to Sit for Speaks, and I do hope you've been enjoying the show so far. Joining us next is Dr. Kitty Stewart from the London School of Economics to talk about some of her latest research on the impact of Brexit on social policy.
I'm Alison Kroll, and I'm here with Dr. Kitty Stewart. She's an associate professor at the London School of Economics and Political Science. Thanks for joining us, Kitty.
A pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Great. So we can start by just hearing a bit about what you do at LSE. Can you tell us about your role?
So I am an associate professor of social policy. So I teach in the social policy department at LSE. And I'm also a part of the Centre for Analysis of Social Exclusion, which is a research centre at LSE focused on poverty, social exclusion and inequalities. Both my teaching and my research are particularly interested in policy and what policy can do to make a difference to poverty, to inequality, and to people's lives.
Okay, thanks. So you wrote a paper in February of last year about the potential social and economic impacts of the UK leaving the European Union. Could you tell us a bit about the paper?
Yes, so the paper was really part of a broader set of work that we're doing at the Research Centre. We've been tracking the impact of government policies on poverty and inequality and public services since going back to the Labour years, and so going back really right to 1997. And obviously in this most recent period, since 2015, one of the big things that's happened is Brexit. So we wanted to look at what the impact of Brexit is likely to be on people's everyday lives, the things that make a difference to them, living standards, healthcare services, education, housing, and so on. And I guess the other thing maybe I should say is that I was also interested in doing this because I would say that I'm very attached. I guess I have an emotional attachment to my European citizenship. I did my PhD in Florence at the European University Institute. Oh. My husband is Portuguese. My children are dual national. So for me, the result of the referendum, as it was, I know, for many people, was quite shocking and upsetting. And I wanted to look at the evidence. I sort of wanted to cheer myself up, if I'm honest. I thought there are two sides to every story. I don't want to leave the EU, but there must be, and there may be negative consequences, but perhaps there are also some positive aspects of this as well. So I wanted to look at the research evidence and come to a kind of balanced view that maybe that there would be some plus sides.
So you touched on concerns about the freedom of movement and how it will affect public services in the UK. Could you elaborate a bit on that?
Yes. So that was one of the big things put forward in the referendum, that perhaps the immigration that had come as a result of our membership and a result of the opening up to Eastern Europe in particular had potentially had quite difficult consequences here in terms of pressure on public services, as some of the rhetoric that we see, and that this might have led to increased waiting lists and so on. So we looked in the paper at the evidence for this and also the evidence of what role EU migrants have played in the provision of public services as well. And what we find, in fact, is that they have played a much bigger role in delivering public services than in placing pressure on them. So, for example, in terms of health services, migrants tend to be young, they tend to be healthy, they actually use health services much less than an average member of the UK population, for example. But at the same time, they are quite an important part of the workforce. So they've come here and they've filled gaps, both in skilled, very, very skilled labour, such as in medicine, doctors and consultants. You know, in some specialisms, EU migrants are more than 50% of consultants.
Wow.
Overall, it's much smaller than that, but still 5-10% of the NHS workforce comes from other EU countries. They are nurses and they work in social care and other areas as well. And then some things that we don't think about maybe so much. So a lot of construction workers are from the EU. So when we think about social housing, that's another area where people feel that migrants have placed a lot of pressure on housing. But in fact, it looks like the reason that there are such long waiting lists for something like social housing is because we haven't been investing enough in constructing housing.
Right.
And that's EU migrants are actually playing a role in building houses. And so that's something else that might be expected to get worse after Brexit.
Good. Very interesting. Thank you. Your paper also touched on the political consequences of Brexit. What are your thoughts on the political landscape as a result of the most recent general election? How will that impact Brexit?
I think there are two aspects, really. I mean, there's one, how will it impact Brexit? It looks like we're likely to get what we call a harder Brexit, so possibly a more distant relationship from the EU than we might have had. That's the kind of signals that the government's putting out. I mean, it's very difficult to predict. And on the other hand, so we've got Boris Johnson has a big majority, might make it easier, give him a bit more flexibility in negotiations because he's going to be a bit less accountable to the more extreme Brexiteers in his party. So who knows, it could actually go either way. It's also quite interesting in terms of kind of social policy more broadly, because one of the things that was interesting about the referendum was that looking back to 2015, we had a government, we had Cameron, we had Osborne, and it looked like they would be in office for 5 years. They had pledged to make quite big changes, cuts to the welfare budget, for example, changes to the way social housing is provided. And the referendum and the rise of Theresa May really sort of changed that. And she did have quite a different approach to social policy.
Mm-hmm.
Some of mostly the welfare cuts went ahead, but she, for example, stopped the changes that were taking place to social housing. She put a brake on changes that were taking place in education, the push towards academisation. So it looked at that time like a kind of knock-on effect of the referendum, sort of unexpected, unintended consequence would be that maybe some of the social policy reform, there'd be a bit of a break on social policy reforms. And we did indeed see very little, not much changed over the next couple of years, I guess because of the focus on Brexit. Now it's interesting because we've got, you know, a really large Conservative majority who does look like it's going to have 5 years in office. So on the one hand, there's the implications of Brexit. And on the other hand, potentially, you know, we're going to see some other reforms beyond Brexit to social policy areas.
You also touched on how the impact of Brexit is going to vary around the country and how different regions of the UK will be disproportionately affected by it in both positive and negative ways. Could you provide some more detail on this? In what areas do you think the differences will be most prominent?
There are some different projections about which regions will be affected. So the general consensus is that areas that do the most, that have are most dependent on trade with the EU in their economies are going to be the most affected. And those are areas in, for example, the Northeast, the Midlands, often areas that are already actually some of the poorer areas in the country, Wales, also Northern Ireland. So because it looks as if it's quite likely that these effects will lead to kind of increases in regional inequalities. Not everybody agrees with that. So some people say that actually London and the South East are in the position where they'll be probably most affected, partly because of their proximity. So suddenly the importance of being close to the EU as our, you know, close to the Calais-Dover crossing is a bit less important if we start to trade with countries further away, and partly because of the importance of financial services in the London economy, and financial services in general are likely to face bigger barriers to trade. And financial services are really at risk because at the moment they have rights to operate across European countries. It looks like they'll probably lose those. So that's a bit of a risk for London and the South East. On the other hand, those economies are bigger, they're more diverse, and they're probably more able to sustain that impact. So possibly even if the impact is larger in London and the South East, looking ahead, they'll bounce back quicker. That's, for example, that's what happened after the 2007-08 recession. So I think there are real concerns for regions of the country that are already more disadvantaged. And I think it's really important the government grasps that and has a serious regional investment strategy.
Okay. So do you see any positives for UK social policy as a result of Brexit?
So I started off by explaining that, you know, we aimed to do that in this paper. We really wanted to find some. And I'll be honest, it was really difficult. On the one hand, there's the economic impact, the broader economic impact we haven't talked about, that we know that the economy, we're pretty certain the economy is going to grow more slowly. So that's an impact on living standards, but it also makes it more difficult to raise money for public services because tax revenues are affected.
Right.
So that's a sort of broad constraint which kind of underlies all, it's going to make it more difficult to meet some of the other challenges. On top of that, we've discussed the impact of reduced migration and what that might mean, make it more difficult to deliver public services. And those migrants we know may actually make a net contribution. They make a net fiscal contribution to our budget. So that's another, if they stop coming in such numbers, then that's, again, going to make things more difficult fiscally. We're going to have more freedoms. I mean, there's been a lot of talk about freedom and taking back control. And in some areas, I mean, it may be democratic, but that also raises some sort of concerns and worries. So, for example, we have benefited, workers here have benefited from the imposition, really, of employment rights, which our own government would not have agreed to. I mean, they were sort of pushed into it. So particularly things protecting workers who work long hours, who work in precarious jobs, part-time jobs, their employment rights are much stronger as a result of our EU membership. So freedom could mean, you know, the watering down of some of those rights. There is some discussion that perhaps it would allow us to do things differently in terms of industrial strategy, that it would allow us to protect and support certain industries. So, for example, when the steel industry was in trouble in Port Talbot, EU competition laws make it difficult for a government to kind of protect and intervene and protect a particular industry because it's trying to ensure fair competition for all parts of the EU and for all companies. The only thing about that, if we do gain freedom, let's say, from EU competition laws, you know, there are questions about how much difference that will really make, because in fact, the extent to which our government uses its ability within the current laws to invest in what we call state aid, to invest in industries, we do that much less than countries like Germany and France. So there's a lot more freedom even within the current regulations that we're not making use of. So I'm a little bit sceptical that these additional freedoms we might gain will lead to big, big changes.
All right, great. We're set to leave the EU on the 31st of January, and Boris is adamant that the deadline to agree a deal with the EU won't extend beyond 2020. Do you think there's anything the government needs to be most mindful of going into this stage of negotiation and this stage of transition?
So my view is that the most important thing, given what we see from the evidence, is to negotiate the closest possible relationship with the EU. I mean, I think the least worst option at this point would be to stay in the single market, to stay in the customs union. I know that that's not something the government will do, or certainly won't agree to do that with those labels on it. I'm still a little bit hopeful that something close to that, called something different, can be negotiated. And I think that that would make every sense, both for our economy, for our public services, and to ensure that UK citizens continue to enjoy the rights and freedoms that EU membership has given us.
So if any of our listeners want to find out more about your work, where should they go look for it?
So they should go to our website. It's the Centre for Analysis of Social Exclusion at the LSE. And this is part of a broader project called Social Policy and Distributional Outcomes in a Changing Britain, I think is the full title. But if they Google any part of that, they'll probably find me and this paper and other papers as part of that project.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for joining us.
A pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
thank you so much to Dr. Kitty Stewart for joining us on this month's podcast. That's about all we've got time for this episode, so thank you very much to all of our speakers for joining us this month. And thank you to all of you, our listeners, for continuing to tune in to Sit for Speaks. We sincerely hope you've been enjoying the podcast so far, and we look forward to welcoming you back for our episode in February.